This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Vito Mabruco, who's the global CMO for NTT Corporation. Vito, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here. Thank you. I am the global CMO for the NTT Corporation, which is the parent company of a number of operating companies, including NTT Docomo, NTT Data, and others. And my role is to help message and create a better understanding in the marketplace of the NTT Corporation's mission, values, and investments in innovation. The last year, we've been very focused on talking about new innovations coming out of our R&D lab. My team is the one who's taking that message to market, to our customers, to our employees, and to others.
Your investment into R&D is way above the average. It's about 30% of global profit, is that right?
Yes, it's been like that for a long time. We're a 150-year-old company born out of R&D because we started with the telephone and the telegraph. That level of investment has never wavered. We used to be a government department, so it wasn't profit-based. But 30% of our profit every year, which works out to, depending on the yen, $3-4 billion a year consistently. That is primary research. It's not research that you invented today and it goes to market in 6 months. We're talking about things you invent and then reinvent and then reinvent and then it gets to a market 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years later. It's the classic 20-year overnight success. When did that happen? Well, it started 10 years ago and now we're here. So that's the kind of R&D investments we make.
When you look at that R&D, one of the challenges for a lot of companies who invest heavily in R&D is monetizing it themselves. There's an awful lot of patents out there that sit idle for a long time because companies create stuff, it's not in their core market, and they're not necessarily very good at monetizing. How do you ensure that having invested this $3 billion a year in R&D, you are actually getting a return from investment, whether that be through yourselves or by licensing?
It's a very good question and a very good point. To be honest, we haven't done a very good job on that. Many R&D companies tend to think that if we invent it, they will come. But what we've learned and what we are changing is that we need to start. Now, even the market may not know what's coming. You can't always go to the market. You have to be ahead of the market. We've now invested in a group internally. It's called R&D Market Insight Team. They do the traditional, let's look at the market, let's look at customers, let's do competitive assessment, and then let's try and do some predictions, use some external input, and start to be a little more prescriptive about our investments so that we just don't invest in things and not know if they're going to make it or not. We're getting better at it. We have to because it's a lot of investment. Also, we've got a much stronger connection with what we call our OpCos. They're critical because they're facing the customer. NTT Data is our global operating company serving customers outside of Japan. They're very important to our R&D strategy because we need to take cues from them. That's now really started to ramp up in the last year or two because we've had an integration of a couple of global companies. We now are very dependent and codependent on them because we're investing, frankly, their money because we're a cost center as a headquarters and as an R&D. We're asking them, where do you want us to invest? Where is the market going? Give us your feedback. Once we agree, they also have a responsibility to commercialize it. They're the ones who have the commercialization goals. Works very well if we both cooperate and collaborate. That way they get something out of it and NTT grows the business.
I was looking around the presentations at Upgrade yesterday and some of them caught my eye, the digital twin around the cardio work, the photosynthesis work which removes CO2 from the air and ends up bringing just carbon monoxide which you put back into the supply chain and water. But also there's a project in there I own that you've been working on for a couple of years. But it's still another 10 years or so before you expect that to really become a big issue. Can you explain to the listeners what ION is?
ION is, frankly, the big bet that we're making in terms of the R&D investments of the future. It started in 2019 when three top executives, our CEO, our CTO, and our head of R&D, wrote a book called ION, Beyond the Internet. You can get it on Amazon. They predicted the need for a new infrastructure of the future to deal with the volumes of data and processing that was coming. That was before AI. That was 2019. And they already saw that the infrastructure we have today just won't support the demand for data, especially once you start getting to digital twin and some of the metaverse type stuff. They said, we need to think about a new infrastructure based on the concept around photonics. As a telco, have already been very familiar with fiber. You know, undersea cable fiber, fiber to the home. In Japan, we were the first to do, around the world, we were the first to do fiber to the home. We took that knowledge about optical networks and optical fiber, and they concluded that we need to create a photonics-based infrastructure, meaning networking and computing. That has several advantages. One, it takes significantly less power for the same amount of capacity. Two, it's much faster. Three, it's got low latency. Low latency now has become a critical requirement for AI, especially when you get into robotics and you start putting AI at the edge. IONE stands for Innovative Optical and Wireless Network. Well, interesting set of words. It's basically a photonics-based infrastructure of the future, both for networking and computing, from the data center to devices to cars, using photonics to drive network both across the network and within data centers and devices. We invented a specific device called the Photonics Electronics Convergence Device, a PEC we call it, which allows us to create more photonics-based networking and computing as we miniaturize it. It's not a 10-year plan. It's actually here now. Maybe the 10-year is critical mass, but the reality is it's here now. We are doing all photonics networks now. Is it commercial and is it people buying it? Is it flying off the shelves? No, but we're proving that it works. These things, like everything in our IT industry, never happen overnight. They happen over time. I liken it to going from incandescent to LED or going from tubes to transistors. Those took time. And so that's how we look at it. This is a 10-year journey, but it's starting now.
One of the challenges with this industry is that nothing's ever new. If we look at photonics, we've had fiber from data center to data center interconnect now for a good 10, 15, 20 plus years. What makes this more than just the next generation of fiber-driven communications?
Those fiber connections were basically, let's call them dumb lines, transmission lines. They're just moving bits. IONE and the All Photonics Network is using a much more intelligent system that is not just a fiber, but it's also the partners and the devices at the endpoints. We have concluded, and this is no surprise, is that we can't do this alone. There's no amount of money we could spend to transition an industry. We partner with some of the largest companies, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, Ericsson, Nokia, Cisco, Red Hat, you name them, 130 of them, in a consortium. And the idea being that it's not just a fiber, it's the intelligence, it's the software, it's the device, it's the going from photonics to electronics. So it's a different implementation of that, using endpoints and software at both ends, that is different than just a transmission cable. That's how we see the future, is not just using fiber optics for fast transmission, but it's more intelligent transmission.
What does it change in terms of the data center itself? If I look at the evolution of storage in a data center, we've had fiber connection for some time. Same as for networking inside the data center. But that hasn't stopped the heat and the power consumption. One of the claims that you are making as a company around the potential for IONE is a massive reduction in the power needed, a significant reduction in the heat that is generated. Where does this change? Because we already see fiber external to the boxes. Is this going to improve that? And if so, where do we lose heat and save power? Also inside boxes, how do we put it in there? Because that's our big power and heat suck.
It's inside the box that our power savings are going to come from. Yes, of course, we've got fiber on the back planes and all of that's connected, but inside the boxes, inside the boards, inside the chipsets, they're still based on silicon. We keep trying to shrink it, we try to disperse the heat. We have a device, this PEC, which allows you to use photonics to move data and bits inside the system, whether it's between boards or on the board or inside the chip package. Some people call it silicon photonics. It's not quite that. It's more the connection of the GPUs and the CPUs and the XPUs using this photonics converter called the PEC. This company we started last year called Entity Innovative Devices, its goal is to create these PECs such that they can be miniaturized to the point where you can implement them on a chip. And this is why Intel and Qualcomm and NVIDIA are so interested in it, because we've invested billions in creating this device and this concept. If they can use that in their technologies, they can significantly reduce the power requirements of their chip technology. We see this going to the next level within like five phase. Phase one is networking. Phase two is data center within systems. Phase three is between boards. And phase four is between chips. And eventually, even in a phone, in a car, you can have photonics-based connections that reduce the power requirements of moving data in bits. You're taking the concept of low heat, high speed, light emitting type photonics and shrinking it down to the level of devices.
I mean, one of the big things that moved machine learning on and opened the door to generative AI was our ability to not have the CPU as a bottleneck. The work that NVIDIA and IBM did around the PowerPC meant that data was moved directly from the GPU to memory and back again. Shifted things substantially, and the two companies have built an awful lot of really clever IP around that and made very fast connections. But it's still copper-based, it's still silicon-based inside the machine. How do you begin to change that? Because at some point you've got to interpret this from the chip into the photonics to send it to the next level. If our memory is all chip-based, and our GPUs, CPUs are all chip-based, and our backboard inside our devices are still chip and copper-based, where do you add that photonics element that becomes cost-effective and is something they can engineer at mass?
Okay, there's a few questions there. First of all, the question of how do you go from copper electronics to photonics? That goes back to removing the electronics connections at the chip level or at the board level using this PEC device. You're never going to get rid of electronics, but you can reduce the amount needed to move and transmit data between that GPU and that CPU using a photonics connection. Number two, it has to be at scale. That's why we are using an approach of open, not open IP, but open collaboration. I liken it to Bluetooth. It started as a proprietary thing, and they wanted to hold it, but it never worked. Everyone had a different version of it. We don't want a different version of this. We want an industry-wide standard, because we prefer and think it's better to have a bigger pie, of which we have a smaller slice, than no pie at all. That gets you scale, because without scale, it doesn't matter. The best technology in the world without scale just sits on the shelf. Nobody uses it, and we've seen that before. Those are the principles that we're looking towards, but the thing about AI is interesting, because we've been talking to a number of companies, of course, our partners, NVIDIA. Everyone's worried about the infrastructure of the future for AI, right? Electricity and power and heat, especially in the U.S. where the grids are very not consistent depending on which state you're in, and it's a very old system. We're going to need to double and triple the amount of electricity used to generate all of the computing power. This is the right time for a photonics-based discussion. We were in a meeting with some folks in Washington from the Department of Energy. Their whole focus was on, well, how do we get more power, cheaper power, build out the grid? My point was, what if we just don't create the need for the power? What if we, instead of working on the supply side of electricity, why don't we work on the demand side and lower the demand required without impacting capacity? We need that discussion around what are the alternative technologies that reduce the demand for power and still give you the performance or even better performance than what you have. You need to do both. You need a supply side solution, and we're more on the demand side. I'd say just don't create the heat, and then you don't have to dissipate it. I go back to our old technologies. You remember tubes and TVs? They kept breaking, and they'd heat up the house. This is not a long-term scalable solution. The other day, I was at home, and everyone's replaced their lights with LEDs. There was one lamp in a room, and I forgot, and I went to reach in, and it was still incandescent. It was like 5 minutes. I had turned on the light. I burned my fingers. How much heat did we use to create with all these lights? That's the concept. Get rid of the heat. Don't just try to figure out how to dissipate it. Just don't create it at all.
The use cases, as you and I were discussing before we started the podcast, are always the big challenge. People want to see a use case before they do things. You've announced some testing you've been doing between two data centers, one here in the US and one in the UK, where you're transmitting over distances of 4K to 79K. How easy is it going to be to scale that up across a lot of data centers? Because all this interconnect is already fiber-based, but all the equipment has to now change to do photonics, and that means cost. And we know many data center owners are not running at the largest profit these days. How do you create that revolution from showing what can be done, or is it a case of waiting for enterprises to say to the data centers, we're going to go elsewhere because it's faster, and more importantly, it's lower energy?
You need both a supply and demand side approach. What you're talking about is our connecting data centers at a level of latency and speed where the data centers don't know that they're actually physically in different places. This idea of having GPU in one place and data in another, to the system, it looks like one computer, even though it's 80 kilometers apart. So you say, okay, so what's the big deal? You did that, so what? We call it disaggregated computing. Does that mean now I can put data centers anywhere? Can I put them closer to a renewable energy source? We build behemoth data centers. We put them in one place, and everything comes in and everything goes out. If we had to build many different small data centers where it's lower cost and greener, it's still a huge cost of moving data. Your point about enterprise, they say, I'm measuring my sustainability to net zero. My suppliers need to meet certain requirements, and I need to be able to prove that my data center compute emissions are going down. So, Mr. Data Center, how are you going to do that? We own 120 data centers. We're one of the largest data centers companies in the world. We're doing liquid immersion and heat dissipation and all that stuff, but it's not going to be enough. This idea then of moving data centers closer to renewable, and then these data centers becoming smaller, maybe running off hydrogen-based or ultimately fusion-based. Now you start to distribute these data centers. Remember the old switching stations that we had for a telephone? They go into neighborhoods and you can put them anywhere. It's a bit of a enterprise pull and a industry push. But at the end of the day, if the ROI doesn't come through and they don't see the benefit of it, it's not going to work. That's why we have all these industry partners. And that's why we also say it's not overnight. We'll see some use cases. One big one, we're working with NVIDIA and Red Hat. We have two data centers. We have the large language model learning capability in a GPU data center. We have the data in another data center where it's secure and it's data-centric. What we're testing in this use case is having this GPU data center use the data from a different data center. Today they do that using WAN and caching and replication, but this would be a direct AlphaTonics network connection, which would be low latency, low jitter, and high speed. Now you can move that compute to another location. You can do heavy resource-intensive GPU work, but still keep the data in the same place. When you do that, you reduce the time, because when you're using cache and WAN and traditional methods, it could take 2-3 weeks. Our goal is to get it under a week. It's not just the fact that you can move it, but you can do it faster. Now start doing ROI on that. In the future, everyone's going to want their own custom AI model. Ultimately, we're each going to have our own custom AI model. Maybe there's AI training as a service, and you have a company that says, you bring your data, we secure it, and we'll create your LLM for your own AI world. You can't do that unless it's very economical. Maybe those are the kinds of business cases that may happen, but we can't guarantee it. We want to make the technology available and then get the creativity behind it.
I'll come back to that disaggregated computing in a minute. I'd just like to stay on this idea of moving the data center closer to the source of power. One of the things a lot of people don't understand is that with all the power lines we have out there, we lose a reasonable percentage of the power we generate during transmission. Have you looked at the potential savings from having the data centers closer to the generating point rather than losing during transmission?
I don't have the numbers at the tip of my tongue, but we're a Japanese company. We have this big demand for compute in Japan. We've done the analysis in Japan, and in Japan, electricity pricing is very variable between urban and rural. We looked at the math and said, well, if we can move things to Hokkaido or to the north or to the south away from Tokyo and still have the same performance, there's significant, not just power rates, but power loss is improved. The business case in Japan is pretty clear because it's a very intense, small location. We think that same business case can be made in the U.S., even though it's a bigger land space. There's still this idea of reducing power loss and moving closer to renewables with smaller footprints. But the business case still has to be proven.
And of course, there's the risk of unintended consequences that if you mount rural, there'll be more consumption rural, which will change those rates. You'll have to look at what the impact will be on people who live in those areas whose income is not high to begin with. And if you move the data center into rural, you will drive prices up because there'll be more consumption in that zone.
What's happening now, of course, is big companies are making their own renewable energy and driving it. But there's a bit of a, and Europe is probably leading in this area, where there's also the opposite happening. people are saying no more data centers in my location because it's driving price up. No more data centers because it's sucking all our energy and we're paying more for that energy. You might end up leveling out the pricing and move that out there. But again, there's also this view that ultimately we're going to need to have alternative sources of energy and renewables, whether it's wind, solar, and ultimately fusion of some kind, will make this more, I guess, viable.
Before we go back to aggregated computing, as a company, you've got a constant build process for new data centers. Are you already projecting forward the building of a data center with an associated wind or solar wave generated next to it so that you can demonstrate that you can consume directly into their power savings and then make that a completely photonics-driven data center?
I don't know the details of our data center strategy, but given our objective to be a net zero company by 2040, that has to be part of the strategy. NTT Corporation is committed to net zero. 45% of that is by implementing ION technology. We're committed to photonics as our infrastructure, both on the network and on the computing side. The other 45% is through renewable energy. We actually have a company called NTT Anode Energy. They're the second or third largest renewable energy company in Japan. They're going to power all of NTT. This renewable energy company starts with powering NTT, which is a major company in Japan. In Japan, NTT consumes 1% of all the electricity in Japan. It's a commercial business as well. So if we can do it for ourselves, then we can create that same model for other companies who want to create a renewable energy strategy for their data centers, for their factories, for their offices. We see renewable energy as the other side of the coin. It's not just the technology, because we also create heat by creating more data centers. We're committing to being a renewable energy company as well. And that is pretty unique for a technology company to be both a technology company and an energy company at the same time. That's our strategy long term.
Disaggregated computing. It's not a new topic. It's been around for about a decade now. It came out of some of the challenges we were having with high performance computing. But even within a single data center, even a data center room where we've got fiber interconnect between the various components, we've struggled to deliver the ultra high speed that we thought disaggregated with fiber would give us in that contained space. You're now looking to take that a significant step forward, and not just in a room or in a data center, but potentially in different cities, possibly different territories. How do you see that happening? What sort of time scale do you have on that? And how much confidence do you have that you can match the speed within a machine or a building to being so separated?
Well, the first step is to prove that you can do it at a, like you say, what latency and what speed do you need? And so the first step is to prove that you can do it. We do have a use case right now, a customer, MUFG, major financial services company in Japan, where we're trying to prove this. It's NTT Data and MUFG, and we're building the financial services APN infrastructure. Using our NoPhotonics network for this banking MUFG, we can do near-instant migration of workloads in case of disasters or in case of failures, something that banks have always tried to do in the past. That's more of a kind of resilience and availability type solution. The true disaggregated approach has to be such that when we do these use cases, we have benchmarks and we say, okay, if we can get to this level of latency, then we can separate the storage from the processing, from the GPU. We start by understanding what the benchmarks are and then use the APN with the technologies and our partners, the communications, and say, okay, we've proven that we can meet the benchmark. Now we need to build the application and the solution above it. We don't come at it as just saying, yeah, we can do it. First, we have to prove the numbers, and we're showing it. Almost all our use cases have this measurement to make sure that, okay, if it works, now we got to go to the business world and say, we've proven it works. Can we find an application or example to bring it to life? That's, like I said, the 20-year overnight success. All of that's happening now. One day you're going to say, oh, wow, somebody just disaggregated this whole computing infrastructure, storage, GPU, and processing are in 100 kilometers apart. That's unbelievable, which we can't do today.
One of the potential challenges I see is that of cybersecurity and data protection. We are seeing an awful lot more data sovereignty over the last decade. We're seeing a lot more focus on how we secure data. We have an existing problem at the moment. We all talk about data being encrypted at rest, in transit. The problem is that when we utilize data, it can't be encrypted in a lot of what we do. And that's because our tools can't cope with encrypted data. Fully homomorphic encryption is the leading technology, where once encrypted, everything stays encrypted. Even the questions are encrypted before being applied to the data. But network and processing have always been a challenge to deploying that level of encryption and protection. Do you see photonics as having the potential for making those types of use cases much more realistic?
Yes, the idea is to prove that we can generate significant amounts of capacity and reduction in latency to allow you to layer on another level of security that isn't so much security overhead than actual processing. When we look at the photonics-based networks, we see 125 increase in speed and capacity. If we can do things faster, the concept is then there's more opportunity to do more processing around security. It's a question that Global Forum has to answer that says, if we can drive increased capacity, increased speed, without generating more heat, we have excess processing potential. Can we do more encryption, decryption, and security type overhead? That's how we see it being delivered. We ourselves are not delivering the actual security protocols, but if we deliver this photonic network that has this capacity and bandwidth and latency, then the business application says, can we use this for more secure-based processing and transmission? That's how we hope to enable that, as opposed to actually solve that.
If we go back a decade, there was an assumption that we wouldn't have AI until we solved the problem of neural networking. And the problem with neural network is the number of nodes, the amount of connections, replicating a human synapse and the speed of firing and everything else. As a result, it got parked, but other problems got solved and we have generative AI and other things on the market now. Is an APN now table stakes for the next stage towards getting us to a true neural network?
I can tell you some of our most interested customers are NVIDIA, Qualcomm, and Intel. Google announced their recent announcements for more chipsets. At some level, there needs to be a photonics-based complement to the existing infrastructure or the existing chipsets that these folks are making. Is it the solution? Of course, nothing is a single solution. But a light-based photonics approach, which, by the way, we're not the only ones doing. We were not suggesting that APN is so unique that any, you know. But the concept of photonics in computing to reduce power, to increase capacity, to meet that next level of neural networks, we're hitting Moore's Law. You can't push any more data through silicon without increasing such heat that you can't put it in a phone anymore. I like to talk about phones and how we think they're so smart, but they're actually not that smart. Turn your network connection off and it's just an MP3 player and a camera. Why can't that have more processing without a network? Why can't we have an AI processor, which Google's doing some of it and other is Samsung? That phone should be way more powerful than it is, but we can't put any more heat in there. We've hit this limit of heat. That's why I say this photonics progression eventually all the way to chips and even further to sensors. Think about sensors. We keep talking about automated driving and all these things we're going to do, but you need millions and billions of sensors to do that. And these sensors can't be running on electronics and batteries because they're just going to die. There has to be some low energy usage type of technology to make us all smarter, whether it's at the neural network level or basically your phone, which at some point our phones are going to be, there won't be apps anymore. They'll just be AI. There's a company that came out called Humane. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's the ex-Apple employees. And they created this device. It's like an ambient computing. It's always around you. You talk to it. You project on your hand. There's no screen and all that kind of stuff. And it's the first AI-based personal network. Problem is that you need to change the battery twice a day. But that's okay. That's how technology works. Start with the idea. That idea works. Now you've got to solve the battery problem. So what are you going to do? Yeah. Photonics is one answer. All of these inventions come over time and you progress and you say, oh, that's the answer. This idea of a personal network is also something we've been talking about. We're stuck with this phone. This phone is the only thing that connects us. We don't really have a connection to everything else around us. This idea of us being at the center of the network versus our phone being at the center of the network, where we're just communicating, these walls here would have sensors and your car would know who you are immediately when you walk towards it. It can see you. That futuristic world, we can't get there with silicon only. That's why we think photonics is the future.
Effectively, we have now crossed that line from Moore's Law into post-Moore's Law with photonics.
Photonics is one of the answers. Yep. We have to get there.
Vito, thank you very much for talking with me today.
All right. Thank you. It was very fun and interesting. I appreciate it. Thank you.